Welcome. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. See how that just rolled off my tongue? Let me first say this is my first day in this assignment. I've been a senator for 3 hours, and I look forward to this assignment very much. Many of you are familiar. I served on the House Energy and Environment Committee, and we worked together there, and I look forward to working with this one. One of the great things about this committee, of course, is that we have two of the best administrators in this building, Beth and Shelley. I'm channeling Jackie now. Jackie, you're probably watching, so enjoy. I look forward to us getting a lot of good work done with my colleagues on this committee. So today we have four issues that we're going to be working on. A couple of them are reports back from legislation that was started, that was passed in the 2013 session, and then others are more looking forward. So the first is the Clean Air Fee Study, which is the result of Senate Bill 306. Senators, and for those of you in the public, in the materials that are on OLIS, we have that bill up there for you to look at if you'd like, as well as the presentations from Dr. Liu and from Paul and Mazen. So feel free to look at those wherever you are watching in the state of Oregon. Okay, so first I'm going to call up, I'm going to open the informational hearing on Clean Air Fee Study and call up Paul Werner and Mazen Malik. Gentlemen, where are we?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Werner, Legislative Revenue Office. First of all, Mr. Chair, welcome to the Senate. This is Mazen and I's other part-time job. We part-time for the House and part-time for the Senate. We have put together just a one-page outline, kind of a process-oriented outline for you, entitled Senate Bill 306, Feasibility of Clean Air Tax or Fee in Oregon. And what just wanted to brief you on what we've done from in the Legislative Revenue Office. We have, with the appropriation that was provided to us in the 13th session, we have contracted out with the Northwest Economic Research Center, and they're going to go through an outline with you on what their proposed study is. First of all, the Senate Bill 306 was very prescriptive in terms of what is expected from the report. It directs the Legislative Revenue Office to prepare the report, but then, as I said, it appropriates money to us to contract out for expertise in order to carry out that function. So the first thing we did was to prepare an RFP. And basically the scope of work for that RFP is essentially written in 306. So it wasn't, we didn't have to dream up of things to put in the report. So it's very clearly laid out, and we use that basis. And so any questions you have in terms of kind of the direction, I think is in that, laid out in that report. There are some dates in the report, and one is a December 1 preliminary report due to you, due to the committees on revenue and the environment. We went through this draft outline with the House Revenue Committee this morning. The final report is due November 15th, 2014. In carrying out the task so far, one of the things we wanted to do was to enlist the expertise of state agencies. So we put together what we call a technical advisory committee. And you can see on my one-page outline there who's on that committee, kind of the usual suspects, the agencies that are involved in the issues around Environmental Policy, Department of Energy, the Public Utility Commission, Department of Environmental Qualities, Department of Transportation, Department of Revenue, from the revenue collection standpoint. And then there's this report calls for a lot of economic analysis, economic modeling, and what potential impacts and trade-offs may be associated with a clean air tax or fee. And so the Business Development Department's been brought in and given us feedback as well. So we intend to use this technical advisory group to help us through the report process, giving feedback to the contractors and making sure we're on course. They are also a great source of data and information that will be used by the contractors in their modeling and making sure that those are the most up-to-date and the best information we can put into the model. The other thing that we did with our appropriation is that we used a small portion of it for a personal services contract with an economist that can help us with providing additional regional economic modeling expertise. We've hired Ed Waters, who was with Legislative Revenue Office for a number of years, is an expert in the computable general equilibrium models, was really the primary source of the construction of our OTIM, or Oregon Tax Incidence Model, which is a CGE model of the state economy. So a lot of similar kind of issues come up here in this modeling, so we're very glad that Ed's available to help review the work of the Northwest Economic Research Center, give them and us feedback on that analysis. So if you look on the briefing page there, you can see the timeline that we've laid out. And starting with the release of the RFP on September 3rd, and you know, you go down, we're almost well past halfway down that timeline already, and the review of the project outline with interim committees set for today, November 20th, in the legislative days. Our intent here is to what we're calling this is a draft outline. So, and that's what's been prepared for presentation today. The idea is that to serve as our preliminary report to get feedback from you as a committee and from the House Revenue Committee and others, and use that and build it into a final, outline on December 15th. And from there, that will be the working document going forward. Our intent would be to update this committee and the Revenue Committees and the House Environmental Committee as we go through this next year and kind of where we are, different phases of the project. We did also kind of informally enlist four legislative members to give us some feedback specifically about where we are in this project. So and give us feedback if we're going in the right direction. So we think we've got a good process set up, and we're working closely with the Northwest Economic Research Center, and they're going to come up and go through the outline with you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Paul. Okay. Paul, before you leave, so who are the four legislators who are involved or that you're looking for feedback from?
Mr. Chair, one of them is to your left. No, to your right.
Oh,
to my left.
Okay, great.
Senator Hass, and great. But the you know, kind of the background of this bill itself, it came out of Senate Finance and Revenue as a committee bill, so it doesn't have a you know, identified sponsor. But really, the work on the wording of it came from Senator Dingfelder and Senator Boquist. So Senator Boquist is our other Senate member. We've asked to give us some feedback on the House side. We asked Representative Bence and Representative Bailey.
Okay, great, thank you. Mazen, do you have anything?
Mr. Chair, I just took the chance for your first hearing on the committee as a chair of the Senate Revenue. Excuse me, not the Revenue Committee.
This is the afternoon.
Yes, and you know, I'm managing this project, so I have to pretend that I know everything about carbon tax. It is so. That's what I'm doing.
I'm sure you can pretend very well. Great, thank you. Okay, I'd like to call up our guests from the Northwest Economic Research Center, and Dr. Liu and Jeff Renfro. Thank you for coming. introduce yourselves at your discretion.
Hi, Chair and Senators. My name is Jenny Liu. I'm a faculty member at the Portland State University School of Urban Studies and Planning and also Assistant Director of the Northwest Economic Research Center that is in charge of this report. And so you should already have the documents that we're calling our draft outline. And we're not going to run through that line for line, but you'll see on there we have our outline of all the sections that will be included in the report, as well as more detailed discussion of all the general requirements that that will be discussed and analyzed in our report. So in today's presentation, we'll run through some of the highlights that we've pulled out for your information. Right. So one of the key report features that we're going to focus on is to identify an effective administrative structure for the clean air tax or fee. And what we're talking about in terms of an effective structure, first of all, is to have a fee or tax that reaches economic efficiency, which means that we will be taking a look at literature and studies that take a look at the full cost of carbon as well as the social cost of carbon into our analysis. And we'll also be looking at the framework of the British Columbia carbon tax as well. The second thing here is the effectiveness of how the carbon tax or clean air fee or tax will be effective in terms of reducing the greenhouse gas emissions. So how large of a fee will enable us to reach the 90% of 1990 emission levels by 2030 goals. And finally, we'll also take a look at how cost-effective various means of administration maybe, and you'll find more detail about these in the outline that we've presented. In addition, we will look at the evaluation of economic impacts, the distributional impacts of this clean air tax or fee on various income levels, various households and different income groups. So we will be looking at least at income groups that are spread out into five groups or more, depending on the data that we'll have, to take a look at whether or not low-income groups are disproportionately affected. And we'll also take a look across geographic regions, as you'll see on this map, that we've divided up the Oregon state into six separate regions to take a look at whether or not there are going to be disparate impacts on these separate areas. And you'll see on here that there is the Portland metro area, the Willamette Valley area, North Coast, South Coast, Central Oregon, as well as Eastern Oregon. So I'll turn the floor over to my colleague here.
I'm Jeff Renfro with the Northwest Economic Research Center. So we're going to split the Oregon economy into 70 industry sectors. So we're estimating the impact of the tax and the repatriation method on all 70 of these sectors. But SB 306 directed us to work with Business Oregon to put extra emphasis in the analysis on five key sectors, which are outdoor gear and activewear, high technology, forestry and wood products, advanced manufacturing, and clean tech. So these are incorporated into our normal analysis, but in the final report we'll break these out and highlight the impact to each of these sectors. We're also going to include a special emphasis on agriculture, transportation, state and local government, and other manufacturing sectors. And after we've run our results, we'll also go through and look at surprising results or industries that have a large impact one way or the other, and we'll pull that out as well. This is a significant improvement on our previous study, which had a highly aggregated industry sectoring scheme. So because of changes we're making in the modeling process, we're able to have more specificity by industry and then also by region. And this will incorporate all of the pass-through effects that we were missing in our previous study. Very briefly, the way that we plan to do this is we're starting with a program called CTAM. We used it in our previous study. The core of CTAM is a dynamic energy usage model. So in order to create that, you need to have a dynamic forecast of prices for different fossil fuels into the future. So we're basically going to take the innards out of that model. We're going to take those price forecasts and put them into a different program called REMI. So we're going to model the effect of an energy price increase in the economy and then come back in with the revenues that we generate and put those back in through our repatriation scenarios.
Jeff, yes. What are the acronyms? What do those represent, CTAM and REMI?
Yeah, Chair Dumbro, CTAM is the Carbon Tax Analysis Model, and REMI is Regional Economic Modeling Incorporated.
Yes, Senator Hess.
When you say repatriation, what does that mean? The taxes would go to lower other taxes?
Yeah, Chair Dumbro, Senator Hess. It just means giving the revenue back to the economy in some way. We're going to have a variety of repatriation scenarios, so we'll look at revenue neutral options. So everything will just be distributed through tax cuts, and we'll experiment with different levels of tax cuts. We're also going to look at scenarios that include targeted reinvestment to specific industries or for specific state goals. Our intent in doing this is to demonstrate the trade-offs between these different types of repatriation scenarios so that policymakers have a sense of how all that works. We, in addition to Jenny and myself and the rest of the NERC staff, we also have two physicists from Portland State University who are working with us on this project. So they're going to take our economic impact results and they're going to estimate the reduction in emissions we expect to result from the clean air fear tax. We're going to feed those emissions reductions into a revenue estimator, so we get a dynamic price forecast leading into a dynamic economic forecast, a dynamic emissions forecast, and a dynamic estimation of revenues that the state can expect to take in due to this. We're going to look at treatment of imported and exported energy. We're starting with our starting point is the British Columbia carbon tax system, partly because it has been so successful, and when you look at carbon pricing schemes around the world, it kind of stands out at this point. They do not tax imported or exported energy. There's a variety of reasons for that, but we're going to look at, if we did decide to do that, what are the points at which that becomes a rational choice, and if you decided to do that, how can you actually implement an import or export tax? As I mentioned, we're going to look at a variety of scenarios. The scenarios are going to vary based on fee levels, so we're going to look at low tax prices based on a low carbon price, all the way up to prices that approach the actual total social cost of carbon. And then we're going to look at different ways of repatriating or putting that money back into the economy.
So in addition to all of that analysis, we're also going to provide some background on the costs and benefits of the various existing statutes and regulations that are outlined in SB 306. And so these include things like the Clean Fuels Program, Renewable Portfolio Standards, just to provide a little bit of comparison and background between these existing programs and the new proposed clean air tax or fee. And getting back a little bit to the revenue repatriation options, the way that we're going to characterize the trade-offs is that we're going to take a look at the various options or scenarios that will maximize positive economic impacts in the state and also mitigate the negative impacts on various groups, including low-income households, different geographic regions, the urban versus rural regions, as well as different across different economic sectors. So the way that we're going to look at most of these revenue repatriation options is going to try to address these particular issues that are also outlined in the bill. So I think that's it for our highlight version of the outline.
Well, it sounds very exciting. Thank you. Any questions, colleagues? Yes, Senator Hensel.
Forgive me for my ignorance. I need some help. We're going to the clean air tax or fee is what? What are we looking at? We're going to tax those that emit? Or we're going to potentially... I'm having a hard time figuring out what we're talking about. Excuse me for my ignorance.
Yeah, no. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hansel, in response to that question, what the clean air tax or fee is structured as is a type of fee or tax on greenhouse gas emissions, or more specifically, CO2 emissions that are caused by any combustion that may happen within the state of Oregon. And so that may include gasoline that you use to fuel your cars and are then combusted in your engines. It may include various other energy sources, say natural gas to heat your house, natural gas or other types of energy used in production that are combusted.
Yes, sure.
So the nexus that some are assuming that if we tax it, there'll be less emission because it won't be used as much. It'll be all, is that the basic public policy premise here?
Yes. So in economics, what we're thinking of in environmental economic theory is that if you put a price on something and internalize this kind of price that people aren't taking into account already, the cost of emitting carbon into the atmosphere, that they will then use less of it. And also it will possibly cause substitution into alternative technologies that may be used in production or other things that they might do.
Chair Demarest?
Vice Chair Olson.
In a hypothetical situation, then, if I had a total electric house and drove an electric car, I wouldn't have to pay any taxes?
Chair Jumbro, Vice Chair Olson, if you're using electricity that does not come from any combusted source within Oregon, then yes, you would not have to pay any carbon fees or taxes. But if that electricity comes from, say, a natural gas plant that does emit carbon, then that would be included within the scope of this kind of tax.
Mm-hmm. The tax would not be on your household. It would be on the product at the point of source, or
that is one of the things that we're going to investigate in terms of finding what is the most efficient administrative structure, whether to tax it at the source level or at the household level, depending on the various complications that might occur, say, with household energy versus production. And so I don't have an answer for what is the best at this point.
Yes, Senator Hess.
Thank you. If I could append Senator Olson's comment, in a hypothetical world, if this were to go forward, then you lived in a house like that and drove an electric car, you not only wouldn't have to pay any tax, but your state taxes would hypothetically go down. You'd not only not pay this tax, but you'd have a smaller tax bill because these carbon taxes would offset most likely your income taxes. And to me, I don't want to give up my environmental cred here, but that was more tantalizing, the tax reform aspect of this, than the environmental progress that you might make hypothetically. So that's why I was asking about repatriation. We didn't call it that when we passed the bill, but it's very intriguing. And we are talking about a revenue-neutral scenario here. I think everybody sees that. And so who knows?
Senator Bates.
Hey, just a quick comment. Last week I had two meetings on this unexpectedly, and what kind of got my interest the most was some of the comments I've made here too, but I just asked the question, you know, if someone's wants to really jump off a carbon on an individual basis, what would really get a person, an individual in our community to say, I'm willing to do this, but what do I get personally from it for accepting, say, you know, 2 cents more paying for my gasoline for my car, and knowing we want to be revenue neutral, and kind of things we started thinking about was not just putting it back in the economy, but putting it back in a way that stimulated the economy, actually produced more jobs, not just we're going to stick it back in the economy somewhere. And some of the issues that people started talking about those meetings was, gee, I like to have solar panels in my house, and I like to heat my hot water with solar right now. Can't afford to do it. The upfront cost is too high. But if I accept 2 cents on the gallon of gas, maybe that becomes an option to me and it's something I can afford. Those are the kind of things we're thinking of, and that also, if you somehow can restrict some of that production to the state of Oregon, because we're paying the tax, you know, it stimulates more on the economy from the point of view of jobs, not just installing the stuff from foreign countries, but actually building it here. I assume that's going to be part of the study. You're going to talk about those kinds of things in the study. Is that correct?
Chair Dunbrough, Senator Bates. Yeah, that's specifically one of the repatriation scenarios that I'm sure we're going to include is looking specifically at targeting some of the set-aside money for home energy efficiency improvements, because that's basically the principle that we intend to follow with the repatriation effort is that the mechanism for collecting the revenue and the mechanism for putting it back out just needs to be decoupled. We always want to maintain the incentive to reduce your fossil fuel usage regardless of what's happening on the other end. So if your taxes are lowered or if you have more opportunities to invest in your house or further reduce your fossil fuel usage through targeted investment programs, then that's fine. We just want to make sure that we're keeping the price signal on the front end.
Just for a follow-up, see if you agree with this. Just raising the cost of carbon-based energy, I don't think gets the job done. I think most people don't want to spend any more money on gas than they have to or heat their house any more heavily than they have to. It gets cold, they got to go so we can work every day. I don't see that for middle and low-income people as a real incentive. I just don't see it. Not everybody can afford a Tesla, you know, and that kind of thing. If you can couple this, though, to real ways for people to change how they live through what they do at their home and what they drive every day, then I think you're getting somewhere. But other than that, just moving the money around doesn't get it for me. So I'm looking forward to the study looking at those issues and bringing it back to us, not just things we talk about all the time, but really a good study we can look at before the next session to guide us.
Okay.
Senator Olson.
Is your study going to include the cost of the authority to collect these taxes and how they're and what it's going to cost to re-disseminate them through the populace?
Yes, that's Senator Olson. Yes, we're going to investigate kind of the lowest cost administrative structure. To go back to the BC example, one of the reasons that we chose to base our initial study on that is people in BC will tell you they're very proud that they didn't have to hire any additional people to collect the tax or administer the tax. We're going to look at different tax incidents or placement of the tax, but one thing that is attractive is you can place the tax at the wholesale level, so you place it at a point where taxes are basically already being collected. So the administrative burden, at least on the collection point, is pretty minimal, and we think that we can maintain that for Oregon. Depending on how you want to repatriate the revenues, if you have specifically programs targeted at reducing the regressivity or reducing the negative impact on low-income households, you are adding a little bit of administrative work that needs to be done. So part of our study is going to be looking at the trade-offs between achieving specific policy outcomes, but then also comparing that to the additional administrative costs.
Paula, so what's the piece of cake for the state? What do we get out of it? Are we going to make more revenues? Senator has said it's neutral. Are we going to make more revenues? Or we're taking from my left pocket and putting money into my right pocket? Is that what we're doing? So the benefit only is to get clean air and the state gets nothing.
Well, I would say that it's good for the state to have clean air.
I agree with you.
But I think there are potentially additional benefits, such as Senator Bates addressed. But yes, go on.
Sure. So depending on for the state, and if we are looking at a revenue neutral scheme, the results from our previous study show that if repatriated back in certain scenarios, the revenue neutral scheme can actually create additional jobs in the state, which then may translate into additional revenues in terms of personal income taxes or corporate income taxes for the state. In addition to that, we also have reduced emissions that help us move towards the state's goal in terms of greenhouse gas emissions.
Chair Demereau, just to put back the the background of the Senate bill, Senate Bill 306 basically tried to answer a core question. Primarily, if we change the taxation method that we have today from whatever the points of taxation that we utilize to placing it on the emissions of carbon, of CO2, is that a feasible thing to do? And is it feasible to collect it efficiently? And is it also possible to vary this fee, as you would see in the bill here, in different levels to, let's examine whether it, what happens when it's revenue neutral. Let's examine what happens at different levels of the fee itself and see if we could achieve different goals by doing so. And in addition, once we have done this, we are very interested not to impact the economy negatively. And that's why the Senate Bill 306 specifies that we need to consult with the Business Oregon in order to examine those traded sector industries, as we call them, and see that those industries that are the core industries in Oregon are not impacted negatively. And not only that, but having that cluster of industries that flourish in Oregon, so that economic regime, if you will, that we have here, that if we go to this type of tax, this type of fee, what kind of impact would we have on these industries, and how we could further even stimulate those industries by having different repatriation types of schemes. And then just to add the complexity of this bill, at the end you would have in the J section, tell us after you do all of this, whether we still need all the other statutes, or how does it impact the other statutes that we have about 48 pages of statutes that has to deal with issues of that sort, the greenhouse emissions and the sustainable energies and so on. After you do all of this, you have to make sure that we still need, or we have not impacted all that work that we have been doing for all these years. So what this study and what our friends in Northwest Research Center could actually benefit tremendously from this discussion is by having all these inputs in the issues and the questions that you are posing today as part of this framework that they are trying to do in order to be able, you know, to cross all the T's and dot all the I's, that you come by the time when you have all these options in front of you, that you have all these informed discussions and that we had all these models run through the economy and so on. So if you choose to change the taxation methods, scheme in Oregon, you have all these very well informed and examined, if you will. It's the wind tunnel test, if you will, for you if you want to do that. So that's what the Senate bill is trying to accomplish. That's the context of it, and that's what the what we come here for, basically to get, you know, your input and your advice today.
Thank you very much, Mazen. Okay, Senator Haas and then Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Mazen, for those comments. I was reflecting on when this was before the Senate Revenue Committee earlier this year, there was a great deal of skepticism about carbon tax. And to get those members on board with this study, they had to get some assurances, and there was several amendments to the bill that this would be a real study with no previous bias. It wasn't going to be a study on here's how you get there and here's how we're going to do it. It had to be like, you know, starting from scratch, and at the end the research would be what it is, and maybe even a recommendation saying given all this, it wouldn't be wise to go forward. So I just that was the understanding. That's how I got through this legislature, through that committee, Dr. Warner remembers. And there was a great deal of concern about that.
Thank you. Senator Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've mentioned that B.C. will be the study. Have any other states progressed with this idea or concept or have it on the books themselves within the United States?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hansel, so no other state in the U.S. has already constituted a carbon tax, but California has constituted a carbon cap and trade program that will link up also with, in Canada, Quebec, they will link up their carbon cap and trade programs, which are both a type of carbon taxation in a sense, in that they do put a price on carbon, except that they do it in a different way, where they actually place a limit on how many carbon units can be emitted. It's a different administrative structure.
Thank you.
Great. Well, just in terms of process, you know, first of all, let me say I'm very impressed with the way that this is envisioned, and you get answers to these questions and models. I think it'll be good for Oregon. It'll be good for the country, actually, to see this studied. How soon will you have things to share with us? You know, we come back into our next regular session in February. Will you have anything preliminary to tell us then? Okay, so that's the first question. And the second is, if members do have questions or suggestions, recommendations, perhaps they can send them through Beth, and she'll make sure that they can get to the right place. Okay. So, yes, Mazen.
Yes, Chair Demarro, we would love to hear all your suggestions and comments, and if Beth probably would be the right conduit that brings it to us. We would have a timeline that is, unfortunately, when we got the timeline in the bill, it was a very ambitious timeline, I have to say. So we're working with a stress of time. And we would like to get the outline kind of approved and working with it by the end of this month, starting December 15th. And then from January to September, we don't have prescribed time to come and report, but that definitely something we can do on a quarterly basis or so, that we could come back to you in maybe legislative days. Once we have certain stopping points, if you will, and come to you with where we at, kind of thing. But also in the same time, not to be cognizant not to be caught in mid-sentence kind of thing, right. But also.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, thank you all for coming and sharing this issue with us. Okay, so I'll close this section of the agenda and open the next item, which is Agricultural Water Quality Management Program, and call up Katie Koba and Ray Jandel.
Thank you.
And here I think we're going to be talking about that nexus between agriculture and protecting streams and water and water use.
Yes, we are. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And for you, Mr. Chair, since you were not here a year ago in September when we were last in front of the committee, at that time we were talking about kind of a strategic shift in direction with our agricultural water quality program. And the department has spent the last year really trying to figure out how that's going to work and what it's going to look like. There's been a lot of interest in water quality, and agriculture's part in ensuring water quality in the state is taken care of over the last 2 to 3 years. And with that came a lot of scrutiny with our agriculture water quality program. And a couple of things in particular where we had questions, and I think the program was, maybe set up not in a good way to respond to those questions. And first of all, The fact was, we've spent the last 20 years since the program was implemented working with the agriculture industry and doing lots of great projects on the ground. They've kind of been working on low-hanging fruit, taking advantage of partners that wanted to do things on their property, but it wasn't really focused on working in a stretch of a certain watershed area, monitoring before and after that work was done and documenting changes in terms of effects on water quality. So when we looked at where our program was and where we wanted to go, we really wanted to address a couple things. Thank you. First of all, how we could do a better job at demonstrating the effectiveness of the water quality program. And then secondly, some criticism was aimed at the program because it had up to this point in time been a complaint-based program. And we wanted to think about how we would move away to a more strategic focus on ensuring compliance with the program. So when I was before the committee in September a year ago, I was asked the question how long it would take for us to figure out how we would move away from a complaint-based program and being able to do a better job at demonstrating effectiveness. I responded that I thought it would take us probably a good year to do that, and the good news is we're on track. In the past year, our staff has worked with a number of partners, and Ray's going to go into this effort in a little more detail. I'm just giving you the highlights, but we decided to move forward with two pilot areas in implementing kind of this shift in direction, and we're calling our move and the two pilot areas are called strategic implementation areas. One of those pilots is in Clackamas County and one is in Wasco County, and we've officially kicked off our effort with these pilot areas the middle of last month. We have some very, very important partners in our efforts. Our partnership with DEQ is very, very important, as are our partnerships with our landowners, our soil and water conservation districts, and our watershed councils on the ground. Federal partners include the Natural Resources Conservation Service. I think it's also important to note that our soil and water conservation districts are also kicking off similar work to what we're doing with our strategic implementation areas, in that they have identified focus areas that they are also going to work on at the local level. So we've got basically 45 focus area efforts going on in our two strategic implementation areas being kicked off. I want to stress with the committee that we don't have all the answers right now in terms of how this is going to roll out and how it's going to work on the ground. That's why we chose to do some pilot areas. And I would say in a couple of years, we expect to come back and do an assessment of how the pilots worked. We expect there will be changes. I just can't tell you right now what those changes are going to be. But I think we're very excited about the direction that we're moving in particular to be able to show and demonstrate the great things that landowners have done on the ground and be able to document and monitor the effectiveness of the program. So I'll pause right there, see if you have any kind of preliminary questions, and then we're going to move over to Ray, who has some slides for you.
Go ahead, Ray. Thank you.
Chair Dembrow, members of the committee, my name is Ray Jandel. I'm the Director of Natural Resources and Pesticide Programs at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And we're talking about evaluating progress. Before we do that, just a little background reminder that the Agricultural Water Quality Management Act was passed in 1993 as a means for the agricultural industry to begin looking at water quality issues from agricultural lands and how to resolve them. Main goal is to prevent and control water pollution from agricultural activities. This is not a habitat program. It is water quality, and so that puts some sideboards on what we're able to do, though improving water quality does improve habitat as well. There are 38 water quality management areas in the state. We work with local communities, local committees to help develop plans and rules associated with those areas that are unique for them, and we've been implementing them since 2004. All this work, as Katie had mentioned, is a partnership of a number of different ag organizations. When we talk about the Ag Water Quality Management Act, there's some belief that ODA is the main entity involved in addressing water quality issues on agricultural lands. That is not the case at all. We are just a member of that whole partnership. And without these other partners, we would not be very successful at all. Soil and Water Conservation Districts, USDA, Natural Resource Conservation Service, DEQ, all of them involved. We interact with them on not a weekly basis, a daily basis sometimes as well. And coordinating this effort is looking at a number of different areas. One in particular is working with DEQ, who is the main entity in the state for water quality, delegated responsibility under the, from the EPA for the Clean Water Act. They are involved with ambient monitoring, looking at water quality conditions and how they're changing, aggregated across the watershed. We are also working with them, looking at expectations for riparian vegetation to address the total maximum daily loads that they're responsible for administering. We coordinate with Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and the Natural Resource Conservation Service to make sure that these conservation efforts that we're performing are toward achieving these goals. And we work with the Soil and Water Conservation and others to achieve state goals, and particularly with the districts who receive money from the legislature to work with landowners and do conservation activities, both through education, outreach, and technical assistance. So telling the story, key goal of our process, a lot of what we're doing is looking at water temperature, but it also addresses sediment, nutrients, and other things going into the waterway. And that is looking at stream-side vegetation to keep waters cool, decrease erosion, filter upland flow, and stabilize stream banks. It's an easy thing to say about what we want to achieve. When we start trying to figure out what we're going to measure, that is where the challenge starts coming in. What we can do through our water quality program is look at the percentage of stream site areas meeting the goals and objectives of the area plans and rules. The area plans and rules are designed to address the statewide TMDL expectations. We are also able to look at percentage of stream site areas in compliance with the area rules. There are some things that we can achieve through regulatory process. There are some things that we cannot. The first category, looking at things meeting the goals and objectives, is a broader concept than just regulation. The middle one is just looking at regulation. All this, though, combines to look at water quality. That is the main goal of the water quality program. And it's not looking at individual landowners, particularly for temperature. It's the aggregate across the landscape. And so we do also want to look at the aggregated results of activities and how it affects water quality combined.
Right. Before you go on,
sure.
So how are the area plans designed? Who is involved in the designing of them?
So our rules were established back in 1993, in which we work with an advisory committee of 12 to 15 local landowners and interested parties.
For each area?
For each area. We looked at developing, identifying areas that represented unique. In reality, it's social units, people that have common agricultural practices. The southwest corner of the state, the cranberries and grazing issues are different than the wheat growers up in the north central area of the state versus what we see in the Willamette Valley. So we looked at not only what agricultural activities occur in common, but also look at the various social units. How do people combine to interact together? And so we could make sure we have a coordinated effort in that regard. So we worked to develop that group and develop a plan and rules and implement that over time through their input.
And I might add, Mr. Chair, our first two areas, Ray, correct me if I'm wrong, were the Tualatin Basin and then Bear Creek. Two areas that we first adopted rules in.
That's correct.
So how many are there now?
There are, Chair Denbrough, there are 38 planning areas. There were 39 at one time, but Bear Creek combined with the Rogue River, the Inland Rogue, to become one planning area a number of years ago. 38 right now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So in doing the streamside assessment, there are a number of different levels that we need to consider that we want to be able to document and show progress in. Immediately, we want to be able to talk about our current conditions. That does not tell us where we've been, where we're going, is it in compliance or not, but it tells us this is where we're starting from. We have not had this information as well as we'd like in the past, and so we're looking forward to getting that information established. In the short term, we can also track implementation. People are asking what happens in 2 years. We want to see some progress. Well, we can report on activities that are being performed by various different landowners through the efforts of the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and NRCS. We have been doing that for many years now. We have quite a bit of information on that, but we can track it now based on individual basins and based on current conditions through this process. We also want to compare to interim benchmarks. Over the next number of years, we're not only going to be looking at the vegetation, the current conditions, but what do we need to achieve water quality that we're looking for. And then compare that to the ambient monitoring, monitor effectiveness, looking at how water quality has changed. And that is a broader situation. Water temperature growing trees takes time, and so that's a long-term measurement. We also can have a short-term measurement of looking at current compliance, people that are changing activities and how many people we have that are out of compliance are being addressed over the period of time. That's a measure that we'll be making over the next couple of years and continue as well.
Excuse me, is there a standard width of the buffer zones that meet the goals that you're trying to achieve? And does that vary according to region?
It varies actually according to site. And this is Chair Dembro. It depends on the issue that we're trying to deal with, whether it's bacteria, temperature, and so on. And it depends on the size of the stream. A one-foot-wide stream will have a different expectation than a 40-foot-wide stream in terms of what's needed for providing the water quality functions in terms of stream bank stability and shape. And that's part of the challenge of this program and why we have good technical staff to help us work through that process. So looking at the stream-side vegetation assessment, the reporting goals that we're hoping to be able to provide are documenting the aggregated riparian conditions on ag lands and having a consistent sampling area over time, considering that there's multiple entities between the districts and ODA helping to measure this. We want to be able to have something that's very consistent, and as we move over forward in years, it has to be able to be reported consistently as well. And it is looking at a systematic area to document changes in landscape conditions. Not only this is what we have today, but how is it changing? One of the since we have no new resources to be able to accomplish this, we challenge staff to come up with a strategy that would use existing information. And one of the things that is available to us is documentation in public domain, particularly aerial photographs. Google Earth is information that's available to everybody. What can we pull off of that available data that's updated on a regular basis to help characterize the change in the system that we're looking at? One thing that we found out as we move through this process, that it really is only good for documenting the presence of vegetation along the streams. It does not tell us if a stream is in compliance. It does not tell us if that's the appropriate vegetation for that area. Those are areas that we're going to have to work on. And it's not going to tell us what's going to be needed for water quality. That will depend on whether it's a seasonal or a perennial stream and what the water quality issues might be. And so we can look at those things, small and large size streams, as well as the vegetation. That will help us get to where we need to go, but it will be augmented in the future as we get further area photographs to look at that. And as I mentioned earlier, vegetation needed for water quality varies by size. Many people, we start talking about needing trees along all of our streams. Well, when you have a one-foot-wide stream, it's particularly at seasonal, where it doesn't flow in the summertime, temperature is not an issue. We're probably only looking at grass to hold sediment, maintain stream banks so we don't have erosion moving into the stream. I provide this example. One of the questions is, how wide do we need? Well, we had quite a bit of discussion with our various different entities that we participated with in trying to develop this process. Should it be 35 foot? Should it be 200 foot? Bottom line is, whatever you set, it depends on what stream you're dealing with, but we needed some constant distance to develop a sampling area. So we identified 35 foot as a distance that we're going to measure on either side of the stream in terms of evaluating vegetation, and that does not mean that it's what's necessary to provide water quality functions. It is only our sampling regime, so we have a consistent reporting mechanism from year to year and from entity to entity. I need to be very clear about that, because there's a lot of concern that this was establishing a regulatory backstop, and it is not. It is not a guidance for projects that they need to work in 35 feet. That is not. It is not a no-touch zone. People can still continue to operate in this area. And it does not address site-specific conditions. So we're very upfront that it is not those things. It is solely a sampling area.
And I just want to stress that as well. I know Ray did a really good job of that, Mr. Chair and members, but there's been a lot of discussion about buffers, and I think we need to make it clear this is not a buffer program. This is an assessment area. And what we learn out of that assessment area determines how we would move forward in that 35 feet, if we would need to work in a smaller area, a larger area, it's in compliance, it's not in compliance, but it's an assessment area, not a buffer.
Mm-hmm. So just on that note, did you consider various widths, you know, in a pilot kind of manner to see, you know, what do we get with 35 feet? What do we get with 100 feet? What do we get with 10 feet? You know, et cetera.
Chair Denbrough, yes, we did have a discussion about what to use there, whether we wanted to develop a various width. Part of the challenge for that is that we are working with 45 soil and water conservation districts out there, and we want to try to provide as consistent a process as possible. If we started trying to define a variable width depending on size of streams and other criteria, we would end up getting less similar results in terms of trying to report back on what this is giving us, and so we thought that was more of a detriment than an advantage to try to present that. And also there was a concern that if we had a variable width, then there would become more of an argument that this is the regulatory tool that you're going to use, and that there's expectations of activities would be regulated only within that area. So we didn't want to present that sort of a position either.
I would expect, Mr. Chair and members, that this would be one of the issues that we revisit at the end of our two-year pilot program to see, is this the right assessment area? Should we move into a variable kind of assessment area? I think this is definitely going to be one of those things on the table that we come back and look at based on what we learn.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Olson.
Is this assessment area leading towards a defined legal buffered zone?
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, no.
Okay, thank you.
That is not my intent at all. That's why I'm very adamant that these are not the reasons why we're doing it. We just needed a sampling area so we can be consistent across the state.
To see what works.
And what we can collect data so we can report back to the legislature in terms of how things are changing over time.
So the width of the buffer zone is kind of a fixed variable, right?
And correct.
You'll be looking at other things that can affect the water quality, but because you have that consistent width that allows you to see the effects of the other variables. Is that what you're saying?
Well, when we have 45 soil and water conservation districts who are also doing an assessment and we have our strategic implementation areas, we are going to be trying to collect all that information and aggregate it and report back. These are comparing apples to apples. Mm-hmm. If we had a variable width that people had to apply differently or try to apply similarly across the state, we could end up comparing apples to oranges or to eggs even, and we did not want to be in that position.
And just a reminder for the committee, the Ag Water Quality Program and our Forest Practices Act in the state are different. So the Forest Practices Act is a Best Management Practices Act. The Ag Water Quality Program is not. It's an outcomes-based program. So those are fundamental differences. Forest Practices Act, you have buffers. In our Ag Water Quality Program, we do not. It's focused on the outcomes and what you need to, the suite of tools that you need to put into place to achieve those outcomes. It's two fundamental differences in the program.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you. What exactly are measuring these streams? And the reason it comes to my mind is, I'll take Bear Creek, which you mentioned. It flows through about three different agricultural communities. It flows through four cities. The buffer zone at the Rogue Valley Mall is about 10 feet from the parking lot to where you look down the river or Bear Creek. It actually can now see salmon again for the first time in years. And then in other areas, it's different. So, I mean, how can you measure something in the agricultural section that's downstream from the Rogue Valley Mall or Phoenix or Talent or Ashland? I mean, how does that become meaningful to you?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Bates, that's a very good question because that is a concern that the agricultural community expresses to us quite a bit. And that is part of the reason why this is a landscape-based program, because, and not a water quality-based program, because landowners only have control over their land, and there are certain activities they have control over, and that is managing the vegetation associated with the stream. When we begin to look at the water quality coming off of the urban community, we are not measuring the changes in water quality or the quality of the water in front of a landowner's property because it could be out of compliance through no fault of their own. But they have control over the landscape conditions that are on their land. Water coming off of the urban community, it will be measured at that point in time, and we will measure it below where it comes off the agricultural lands. And we're trying to identify those unique units that are primarily agriculturally oriented to be able to do that.
So follow just for clarity for me. What you're really measuring is what that stream riparian area looks like. That's all you're measuring, not the quality of water itself. which is what the riparian area looks like. Is that correct?
Chair Denbrow, Senator Bates, in my previous slide, I mentioned there are several levels of measurement. One of them is immediately looking at vegetation, the landscape condition. Over time, as the water quality, we'll be also measuring ambient conditions. The legislature funded activities, monitoring of water quality associated with ag lands. Last biennium and we're working with DEQ to do that so we can compare the two and how is ambient water quality changing, temperature, sediment, and so on, as a result of all these agricultural activities. How is that changing over time? And at comparing that to the assessment that we're having. But that is a longer-term measure that we're going to be making.
It's complex.
Now, I have several slides here on aerial photographs because they illustrate several different things. One of them I do show here, that's a 35-foot that we're measuring along this stream. And as you can see, it's a very, very narrow stream. What is necessary there to provide water quality? We have several different perspectives to look at there. Some people would say we need to achieve site potential, which is what that site probably existed prior to European man. It could produce trees, but is that necessary for the goals of this program? The next question is, it could be site capability. Site capability is, what would this produce given changes that man has implemented, whether it's roads or houses or so on. In reality, what we're going to be looking at is what is necessary to produce water quality given what this site could produce. Many of our local advisory committees were very adamant. They wanted to make sure that we were developing expectations on what the area would produce naturally and not grow trees where trees couldn't grow. In this case here, it's growing grass. It's a small stream. If this is an intermittent stream, dries up in the summertime, trees are not necessary to protect water quality. If it is a perennial stream, grasses and shrubs may be all that's necessary. So we, as technical specialists, need to be able to evaluate that, and that will be part of our goal in this assessment process, is to evaluate what is there, what is needed for water quality based on site capability, and use that as our tool to look at progress. Now, as I mentioned, there are some sites that don't grow trees. This is an area over in eastern Oregon, Kirk County. It's a grass edge area. We're not expecting trees to grow here or shrubs. They didn't naturally grow here. We don't expect them. But we do have to evaluate this in terms of the grasses and sedges providing the adequate stream bank stability and looking at that as a tool. So looking at site capable vegetation is an important component of our program. We need to have realistic expectations. So the status of this program right now, as we've been working over the last 2 years, we're working with the soil and water conservation districts. 46 areas have been identified by the districts to focus their efforts to provide technical target outreach, technical assistance, and restoration. And they're doing a pre-assessment and post-assessment, and we'll continue this over time. This is, again, a pilot process for them as well as us. We're looking to see how this comes together across the state, and how we can use that information aggregated up to report back to various interested parties. ODA is augmenting this through our what we are calling strategic implementation areas, and the difference between the two is that we have compliance authority. They do not want it. We don't want them to because it affects their ability to work with landowners. But we do have a compliance authority, and we combine that with technical assistance and restoration provided by the districts to see what progress could be achieved above and beyond just technical assistance and outreach. As I mentioned, these are 46 areas are around the state, so it gives us lots of different opportunities to learn and grow this year. Our two areas are the two pink dots. On the left is the Clackamas County area that Katie mentioned. On the right is the Wasco County area. We did, as Katie mentioned, just initiated this study. In one of those areas is Norrier Creek. We looked at the aerial photographs to try to characterize the vegetation. Interesting data in that tree areas amount to 60% almost of the streams areas measured. 25% was grass ag, and then when we say grass ag, that's areas that look like grazed or meadow areas or hay. And there's only about 2.2% that was bare ag.
Right, just point out where that is, the far right.
It's far right. Yeah. Over there is the bare ag. What is causing that? You know, we will not make the decision whether that's a compliance issue or not. That will require us to go out in the ground and evaluate that. And that is a separate process from this assessment, and we will be doing that only from as a result of visual observations from public right-of-ways or from that's primarily the source resource that we have available to us to be able to identify what other information that's available to us. We do not have ability to access people's land outside of that process unless they grant us permission or through a warrant. So there is some limitation on what we can do through a compliance process. One thing I did want to note for this Norrier Creek area is that we talk about perennial streams versus intermittent streams and the size of streams. We're looking at a total of 6 miles of stream in this Norrier Creek. Three of that is perennial, 3 miles is perennial, and 3 miles is intermittent. So it shows you the amount of stream that is smaller in size, which is quite different than what is typically looked at from a point source perspective. And so it's a new challenge for the state to pursue. So our assessment needs are unique. We have a number of universal concerns that we're hoping to resolve and make sure we're addressing them appropriately over the next 2 years. But our goal is to accurately report change in landscape conditions and water quality over time. So our next steps is to conduct this assessment and continue to learn from it, develop our methods further with our partners, whether it's DEQ or the Soil and Water Conservation Districts or others. Look at water quality monitoring and coordinate that with DEQ so we can start linking the ambient monitoring sites with our activities we're seeing occurring on the ground. But most important is we need to continue coordinating with our other partners because, again, this is an effort that is not solely agriculture, ODA-oriented. It involves all of us. And trying to figure out how we can pull all that information together and report on it in a consolidated manner. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? So, thank you very much for coming. What do you see as our need to stay informed on this issue for the next couple of years?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that I didn't mention in my opening remarks and what's new to us is resources around our ability to do the monitoring. And that's been a weakness in the program for many years. Two biennium ago, the legislature approved federal funds for monitoring in our agency, Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Funds. And in this last legislative session, those fund sources were shifted from the federal funds to general fund. That's a huge benefit for our agency. We work in cooperation with DEQ and the other state agencies on the state's integrated monitoring efforts, and continuing the funding for that monitoring is absolutely critical. Monitoring is not something that you can do for 3 years and then stop for 5 years and then come back and do for 2 years and then stop. It's got to be a consistent point of investment, and when we have budgets that go like this, it's a big challenge. Senator Bates and I have had this conversation for many years. I just can't stress enough the need for the ongoing commitment from the legislature to fund the state's monitoring efforts. I think that would be number one on my list.
Okay, thank you. Thanks to both of you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close this section, and our next section is on clean fuels program. And I'd like to have Paul Garahan, Brian Doherty, and Dick Peterson, please.
Oh, I have to sit in the middle of you guys.
Great. And so I think the focus of our discussion on this program is some recent court work that has happened and responses to that. And Paul, you'll give us a little background and briefing on that. And Brian, you can respond with an industry perspective on the subject. And Dick, you're here as a resource for any questions we might have about the program here in Oregon. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. I'm Paul Garahan. I'm the assistant attorney in charge of the Natural Resources section at the Oregon Department of Justice. And I am here, excuse me, To summarize the Ninth Circuit's recent decision in a challenge to the California low-carbon fuel standards, the background here, of course, is that the legislature in 2009 authorized the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt similar low-carbon fuel standards. There's a sunset provision on that. The EQC has adopted a phase one step toward those standards to start to register some of the fuel providers that would be regulated under standards, but has not proceeded with actually adopting the and implementing the full program, given the fact that the sunset will come in 2015 unless lifted by the legislature. So that's the background here, and the challenge to California standards were that they violated the Federal Commerce Clause, the United States Constitution's Commerce Clause. And so they were challenged in several respects because of alleged violations of the Commerce Clause. The quick summary of the decision by the Ninth Circuit, the district court, the lower court, had held that certain aspects of California's standards violated the Commerce Clause. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the district court's conclusions that those certain aspects were unconstitutional. The important other point here in summary to start off is that the Ninth Circuit did not rule that other states were preempted from adopting their own standards. I'll give a little bit of background here at a general level on the Commerce Clause and California's standard that will help, and then I'll walk through what the Ninth Circuit's decision was. The Commerce Clause is actually a grant of power to Congress to regulate commerce, to regulate interstate commerce. It's been interpreted by the Supreme Court over many, many decades as having a negative or dormant Commerce Clause aspect, and that means that even when Congress hasn't acted, states are prohibited from enacting legislation that unjustifiably discriminates against interstate commerce. The point of that interpretation is to prevent economic protectionism or discrimination by a state. And there are a couple different forms of analysis that courts take based on Supreme Court precedent when they're looking at these questions. First, if a state law or regulation facially discriminates, that is, when you read it on its face, it protects the in-state versus the out-of-state economic activity. So it discriminates on its face. Or if it discriminates in purpose and effect. So there's two different ways the court looks at it. First, it just looks at the language on its face. Is it discriminatory? Second, it looks whether or not it discriminates in purpose and effect. If either of those are the case, then it applies what lawyers call strict scrutiny, which is it's only going to uphold that law if the state can prove that there's no other way to achieve, that it's achieving a legitimate state purpose, and there's no other possible way, non-discriminatory way, to achieve that legitimate purpose. In reality, any regulation subjected to strict scrutiny, overwhelmingly those regulations or laws are held unconstitutional. They can't meet that standard because almost anything a legislature does or a rule it's adopted could be done in a different way that's not discriminatory. If a regulation has impacts on interstate commerce, but it doesn't, either on its face or in purpose and effect, discriminate, but it still is affecting interstate commerce, then the court balances the burdens on interstate commerce versus the benefits of the regulation. If again, they have to be legitimate state purposes behind the law or regulation. When that balancing analysis is done, courts usually uphold the regulation. And one corollary on the Commerce Clause decisions and precedents is that states can't adopt laws that, in effect, control conduct outside the state boundaries. So you can't For example, and I'm just, this is not a hypothetical from a case, but say you had, you were licensing a business and you said, well, here are the requirements you have to meet, and you not only have to meet them in our state, but you have to meet them in every other state. Well, that's controlling their conduct outside the state. So that's the type of thing where a court would look and question whether that is extraterritorial control of those activities. And they would subject that to strict scrutiny again. So that's the background on the Commerce Clause. A little bit of background on California's low carbon fuel standard, and I'm not the policy expert on how this all comes together, but I'll give you the basic because I think it's important to understand the Ninth Circuit's decision. The California low carbon fuel standard, the concept is to assign a life cycle carbon content to all of the motor vehicle fuels that are used. And so the life cycle analysis of the total carbon that's released for that transportation fuel. So that includes all of the inputs. For oil, it includes the energy used to extract the oil, to refine the oil, and then to deliver the final gasoline to the markets, and then in its actual use. For ethanol as an alternative, it includes all of the energy used to grow whatever is being made, usually corn, whatever is being used to make the ethanol. And then the production, how to reduce that into ethanol to make it, the transportation to get the corn from the farm to the production facility, and then the transportation of the finished fuel again to the market, and then burning the fuel. So it's the total life cycle elements of carbon that are involved in providing and using that motor vehicle fuel. The program then establishes carbon intensity requirements, and then there's a credit trading system so that if you provide a fuel that is higher than the required level of carbon intensity, then you have to make up for providing that fuel by buying credits. If you provide a fuel that's below that prescribed carbon intensity, you get credits, and you can sell them to those who need them to offset the debits that they have from the higher carbon fuel they provide. The program relies on some default carbon intensity values for ethanol in order to simplify compliance. So instead of making every fuel provider go out and completely document exactly what the carbon is in their fuel, they say, we know that most of the ethanol that comes from certain locations has certain characteristics in how it is grown, what the feedstocks are. Is it corn? The energy it takes to grow that, where it is produced, the energy it takes to produce, and then the transportation costs, both to production and then to market. And it provides these default pathways are provided on a regional basis in California's plan. So they have for ethanol. So for ethanol, they have a default carbon intensity value for ethanol that's grown and produced in California, a different ethanol pathway carbon intensity value for ethanol from the Midwest, from corn grown in the Midwest, and a different one for ethanol from Brazil, which is another one of the largest ethanol producers and providers. Then there's also an option that if you don't like that default number and you think the way you produce your ethanol is better, you have the option to prove that the carbon in your ethanol is at a lower level. So it was, in terms of the challenges that were brought to California's program, especially on the ethanol issue, it was those default pathways, because when you look on the face of it, the carbon intensity value that's given for Midwest ethanol is higher than the carbon intensity value, default value, that's given for California ethanol. And so the producers outside said, well, that's just discrimination. You're giving an advantage to California, and you're discriminating against us outside the state. So the district court looked at that argument and some other arguments, and the district court in 2011 ruled that the standard, the California standard, violated the Commerce Clause in several different ways. One, that it facially discriminated against out-of-state ethanol. And that was based on those regional pathways, primarily. That, you know, there was a number that was different for Midwest than California, that on its face was discrimination. Second, the standard had impermissibly involved extraterritorial regulation, that essentially California was trying to control conduct outside of its state. And the court said that's unconstitutional extraterritorial regulation of ethanol production. The third was regarding some of the carbon intensity values given for crude oil, and they ruled that those provisions discriminated in their purpose and effect. So remember when we talked about the Commerce Clause, either facial discrimination or discrimination in purpose and effect, both subject that regulation to strict scrutiny. And the district court applied that and determined that it was that the standards, the California standards, were unconstitutional on those three different grounds. And then there was a fourth aspect to the holding, which is something that is the question about whether or not Oregon is preempted here. And that has to do with whether or not California had special immunity from Commerce Clause analysis. Essentially, the background here is that, you know, you may or may not realize that under the Clean Air Act, California kind of has a special place, and it has ever since the Clean Air Act was first adopted, because California had started to adopt certain regulations, primarily on motor vehicle emissions, before the Clean Air Act was adopted. And so part of the Clean Air Act carves out a waiver to let, carves out several different types of waivers for California to essentially let California adopt its own standards and have them not be preempted by federal standards. There are a couple different aspects to the waiver, but the particular waiver at issue here, California argued that by giving California a waiver, that essentially was Congress authorizing California to regulate interstate commerce. So it said we shouldn't even be subject to Commerce Clause analysis because we have this special waiver that lets us adopt these types of programs even when other states might be preempted. And the court said, no, that's not what that waiver says. That in order to get that special place, because Congress can authorize states to take certain actions that do have the effect of discriminating against interstate commerce, if it does so very clearly and explicitly. And so the district court said, that's not what this was. And so, California, you still have to meet the Commerce Clause standards. So that was the district court's decision. And just for full background here, the state of Oregon participated as filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, in defense of California's standard at the district court level. And then again, also filed an amicus brief at the Ninth Circuit as well when it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit decided the case in September of this year, 2013. And it overturned the district court's Commerce Clause conclusions, holding that on the ethanol provisions, they did not facially discriminate, that it was not extraterritorial regulation, that the crude oil provisions did not discriminate in purpose or effect. And then finally, the Ninth Circuit upheld the district court on the issue of whether that waiver provision gave California an exemption from Commerce Clause analysis. The Ninth Circuit agreed that the Commerce Clause analysis still applied, so California didn't get a special waiver from that analysis. On each of those points, I'll give a little bit of background here. On the point on whether the standards discriminated on their face against on the ethanol aspects, the court said it was not discriminatory because there were valid policy reasons for why there was differential treatment. So even though the number was different between California and the Midwest, the Ninth Circuit had said that the district court had had ignored some of the real differences between the different ethanol pathways there. Those real differences resulted in different carbon intensities for each of those. And the interesting thing that the court gets into in its opinion here is that it's not just the fact that after it's made, the ethanol has to be transferred to California, because actually the amount of energy used to transport the corn to wherever the production happens is more significant than transporting the finished fuel to wherever the market is. So to get a lower carbon intensity score, it's actually better to have your production facility closer to where the feedstock is grown. In other words, if the corn were sent from the Midwest and produced in California, that would end up with a higher carbon level than the ethanol that's produced in the Midwest from Midwest corn. So the Ninth Circuit said that, in fact, the standards treat similarly situated fuel providers the same in setting those standards, and that the life cycle analysis is not discriminatory, and that the regionally based default pathways provide even-handed treatment. On the second point, whether or not those provisions amounted to extraterritorial regulations, the Ninth Circuit again held that the California standards regulate only the California fuel market, that it's up to individual businesses to choose whether they participate in that market. Other states are not required to adopt any rules, so this is just California regulating activity in its own market. It's not extraterritorial regulation. The Ninth Circuit then also held that the standard did not discriminate against crude oil in purpose or effect. The Ninth Circuit looked at some of the crude oil issues a little bit more broadly than the district court, said that California sources were not always favored, and the purposes for some of the differences in how some of the different crude oil carbon intensity values were calculated were legitimate and non-discriminatory. Finally, on the issue of California's preemption waiver and whether or not it gave them a waiver from Commerce Clause analysis, this is where the argument that's been raised that the court ostensibly held that Oregon is preempted from adopting its own standards has come up. And the Ninth Circuit quoted from the Clean Air Act, and I'll point out in the information you've been provided, the last two pages are Attachment A and Attachment B. Attachment A provides the full text of the Clean Air Act provision in question here that the Ninth Circuit was interpreting. The Ninth Circuit said, and it quoted the Clean Air Act, saying it preempts state laws prescribing, for purposes of motor vehicle emission control, any control or prohibition respecting any characteristic or component of a fuel or fuel additive. Preempts state laws. So that's a quote from the Ninth Circuit. But the issue before the Ninth Circuit was not whether any other states were preempted. That quote, because the Ninth Circuit in this decision didn't have to get into the issue of are other states preempted, it included only a selective quote of the law. It excludes some key provisions of that section of the Clean Air Act, because that goes on to say that other states are preempted only if, and if you look at Attachment A, this is in little subsection I and II, other states are preempted only if EPA has either published a finding in the Federal Register that no such regulation of a fuel component or characteristic is necessary, or if EPA has adopted its own national regulations of that particular fuel component or characteristic. And EPA has not done either of those, taken either of those steps here. It hasn't decided that no low-carbon fuel standard is necessary, and it hasn't adopted its own low-carbon fuel standard. So that's when a state like Oregon would be preempted. And under, if you look at Attachment A, under capital B at the bottom, that's California's waiver. That provision doesn't say California, but the references only include California. So that's the provision that says California is never preempted. It has this special place where it could adopt its own standards. Well, because California is never preempted, and because no states were parties to this case other than California, that issue was not even before the court. The court would not have even had jurisdiction to have held that other states were preempted. It only had to look at this provision on that issue of whether or not California gets a waiver from the Commerce Clause by this waiver from preemption here. So that the issue of whether Oregon is preempted was not addressed by the court, and it didn't need to review that to make its holding on this issue about California's still being subject to Commerce Clause analysis, and it did not do that. So finally, the current case status. The plaintiffs in this case have requested en banc rehearing. That means, the Ninth Circuit's decision was a three-judge panel, and they want the entire Ninth Circuit. I forget the number of judges on the Ninth Circuit, but there's something like 19, I think. They want them all to have a rehearing and consider this question. And so sometimes such rehearing is granted, and then there would be another hearing before the entire Ninth Circuit. So we're waiting to hear back. If the Ninth Circuit denies that request, then they would have the opportunity to file a petition for certiorari with the U.S. Supreme Court to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the lower court's decision. Absent a successful appeal, the case goes back to the district court. Now, the key here is that I never said, because it's not the case, that the Ninth Circuit ruled that the standard was constitutional. What the Ninth Circuit held was that the district court's decision that it was unconstitutional is reversed. There are a couple things that the Ninth Circuit has directed the district court to go back and look at again. The district court, on these ethanol standards, as I said, they were deciding whether on their face they were discriminatory, and they concluded they were. So they didn't look at whether they were discriminatory in purpose or effect. So that issue is still a live issue. It will go back to the district court, and it will be litigated there. And so then another constitutional decision will be made. And if, in fact, the district court concludes that those provisions discriminate in purpose and effect, it will be subjected to strict scrutiny. If they say there's not a discriminatory effect, then they'll give it the balancing test. And then they'll conclude whether or not it's consistent with the Commerce Clause. So in summary, and for your information, I didn't go into the details. Attachment B is the excerpt of the Ninth Circuit's decision opinion on this issue of preemption. That's those two paragraphs. That was the entire Ninth Circuit analysis on the issue of whether California got this special, basically an exemption from Commerce Clause compliance, in a 71-page opinion. So the court dispatched with California's argument pretty quickly and simply here in these two paragraphs. And in summary, the Ninth Circuit's conclusion was to overturn the district court's conclusions that California's low-carbon fuel standards were unconstitutional, and also the Ninth Circuit did not rule that other states were preempted from adopting their own standards. Happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you very much, Paul. Just first, with the various potential appeals that are in play, what is the timeline that we're looking at for this?
That's always a difficult question. I think you can only go on what's happened in general in the past. I think usually a matter of months we'll probably get a decision on the request for rehearing en banc, and then there'll be a period for seeking review, seeking certiorari for the Supreme Court to review. That usually goes through its own briefing period, and then the Supreme Court takes it up. I would suspect If the en banc rehearing is denied sometime this year or early next year, then the briefing for Supreme Court review would be done sometime by next summer, and then you'd probably hear the Supreme Court decision sometime next fall or during the 2014 and 15 Supreme Court session. That would be my rough estimate. It's all speculation. There are no firm deadlines on when the court decides on the rehearing decision.
Here in Oregon, our clean fuels program faces a sunset that goes into effect when?
It's a 2015 sunset on the authority for the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt standards and enforce standards. The EQC has not yet adopted the requirements other than registration requirements at this point.
Chair Denbro, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, director of DEQ. The sunset is December 31st, 2015. So that's when it is in that period of time.
Great. Vice Chair Olson.
Sir, why did the state of Oregon feel the compulsion to file an amicus brief?
The Attorney General, who controls litigation decisions, determined that it was in the state's interest. The legislature in 2009 had authorized the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt low-carbon fuel standards here in Oregon, and we, in consultation with the Governor's Office and with the Department of Environmental Quality, we reviewed the challenges. We concluded that we thought there were valid legal arguments to be made in support and defense of the state's right to adopt low-carbon fuel standards. And so the Attorney General decided and approved to file amicus briefs in both the District Court and then again at the Ninth Circuit.
Follow-up. Do we have a price tag for that? What did it cost?
Well, we certainly could collect that information. I don't know the cost of that participating in those legal actions offhand, but we'd be happy to get that information for you.
I'd ask the chair if we could have that sent to the committee.
Sure, if you could do that. Paul, how often does the state file amicus briefs? Is this a fairly common thing?
Chair Denbro, it is, I'd say it's not uncommon in various issues and national cases. When we think that the state has interests to defend, I don't know the numbers. Again, I work in the area of natural resources, environmental and natural resources law, and I know that we do so in a lot of other cases also. The National Association of Attorneys General is frequently collating state interests, and states are seeking other states to sign on to similar amicus briefs. And for example, in defense, in the case a couple years ago where the state was defending the argument that forest roads needed to have water quality permits that went up to the Supreme Court, the state solicited and got amicus support from other states at different levels of that case, and especially at the Supreme Court also.
Thank you. Senator Banks?
Thank you. Thanks for the discussion. I answered about 10% of it, so thank you. I kind of know how my patients feel sometimes when I try to explain a complicated case to them. And after 15 minutes of rapt attention and their eyeballs drooping, they ask me, Doc, am I going to live or die? Okay? So what I want to know is Oregon's law constitutional as it now stands in front of the courts after the decision in California at the present time, is it constitutional or not?
Chair Denbro, Senator Bates, I believe that it would be likely that a court would conclude that it is constitutional.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't we move on to Brian now? And, I think that's a great segue.
Chair Dembro, Brian Doherty from Miller Ash Law Firm, representing the Western States Petroleum Association. From your first comments, I believe you indicated you would like to limit our comments to the Ninth Circuit opinion. I think knowing what the other panel members have been through in 2013, they probably appreciate that too. I will be happy to do that and stay away from infeasibility and all those other fun things. To direct to your point to the Ninth Circuit, it was actually 79 pages and not 71, but it was 8 pages full of attorneys that are listed on this case from everywhere you can believe. This was a tremendously complex issue. There was the California District Court judge found this to be unconstitutional on its face. A Commerce Clause analysis requires you to look at these several steps. The Ninth Circuit was a 3-judge opinion. It was a 2-1 opinion. Therefore, I look at this and say, well, it's about a 2-2 tie. We have 2 that found it unconstitutional and 2 that have found it constitutional. It's now going up, as Mr. Garahan said, to the Ninth Circuit en banc, but it is a complex issue. I do want to address one of the comments, and that is the state of Oregon filed an amicus brief for a reason. The state of California was arguing the fact that this Clean Air Act had a preemption and exemption provision, and they, California alone, is exempt, which you've heard the explanation for. And by the way, I appreciate Senator Bates' comments. This is not something that's as clear as mud or very simple to understand, and we haven't even started talking about the low-carbon fuel standard. We're simply talking about a Ninth Circuit opinion. What the state of Oregon argued was exactly this, that don't preempt Oregon from doing this. Please don't do it. So they obviously were concerned, and the issue was being raised. Preemption and exemption was being raised in the briefing down at the district court. Now, the district court found everything to be, on its face, discriminatory. Didn't reach the question. The Ninth Circuit stated in the act, the Clean Air Act preempts state laws prescribing for purposes of motor vehicle emission control or prohibition respecting any characteristic or component of a fuel or fuel additive. California is the only state permitted by the Clean Air Act to prescribe and enforce for the purpose of motor vehicle emission control or prohibition respecting any fuel or fuel additive. Our argument is that they have addressed preemption exemption, and they have said California gets the exemption. Then they say, California, that exemption doesn't clear you from Commerce Clause attack. You need to still address that. Mr. Garahan disagrees. That's why we have judges and lawyers. And there's a lot of on this, and there's a lot of more argument going to be had on this. This is, again, I think it's been in the courts for several years. It's going to be in the courts for years more. That's one issue. One issue on the low carbon fuel standard. There's several others that have been a priority on this. I'd be glad to go into, but I'm understanding we're not getting into the other issues. There is another California state court opinion that said that the California LCFS was improperly promulgated. It is now, it has stopped the implementation of the ratchet down carbon content at 1%. Through 2014, as it's working on promulgating this act. So there is a lot of clouds over this California program, which is the first and only in the nation. So I'd be happy to address any other questions you have.
And let me say, first of all, just to clarify, I'm not saying that we're not going to be asking you back at some point to talk about the program itself. I think we will. But just, you know, to this point, and Mr. Garahan, perhaps you could respond to that. But my sense is that what happened in California was that the California's desire to be automatically exempted from the consideration that was denied. But what was said was that California needs to meet these tests now, and that remains true for Oregon or any other state that would. That would have such a program. And Mr. Aaron, what you're suggesting is that at this point you believe that Oregon could withstand those tests. Is that more or less correct?
Chair Dembro, that is correct. And I, if you'd like me to address the other point, The as I explained in looking at the Ninth Circuit's language, and again, it's attachment B on the document I provided you, and it's the key part is the second paragraph there. And the Ninth Circuit quoted only a select provision because, again, it didn't have to rule whether or not this preemption provision had been kicked in, you know, had been activated by one of those EPA acts. It was analyzing a completely separate question, which is, does California get a pass on Commerce Clause compliance? It's an important difference in the law to, when you're looking at a case, to look at what did the court hold? What is the holding of the case? And the issue before the court was, does California get a pass on Commerce Clause analysis because of its exception under this preemption provision? And the court held no, it doesn't. And the other language in here is just the explanation of how the court got to its holding on that point. It is not a holding in itself. And it, again, it could not have held. Mr. Daugherty said that we had made arguments, and the arguments were to try to distinguish the preemption provision here and to clarify that it wasn't an issue. But again, neither the Western States Petroleum Association, which also filed with the Oregon Petroleum Association, also filed an amicus brief at the Ninth Circuit. Neither they nor the state were parties to the case. So to the extent there was any dispute over that, where they are asserting we're preempted and we're asserting we're not, we're not parties. The court can't decide that issue. It's not before the court to decide at that point. And it did not decide it. It simply included a selective quote of the act, because that's all it needed to decide the issue that was before it, which is whether or not California gets a pass on Commerce Clause compliance.
Mr. Daugherty, one last response.
Yes. I'll put it in simple terms. I think in order to reach the question of California being exempt, you had to get to preemption. And that they went and said what the court said in that document. It's on page 4 of my materials. I've summarized it there. Mr. Garahan disagrees, but we believe the court had, you don't get to whether California is exempt and then talk about whether that exemption gets them off from Commerce Clause unless you get to preemption. If there's no preemption, which is what he's arguing, then you didn't have to get to this question at all of exemption. And we believe the court has triggered that. This is the first time the LCFS has not been discussed really in the courts at all, because California has the first in the nation. So this Clean Air Act's been around a long time with that specific exemption to allow California to do this. We think they went to preemption, got to exemption, and then said your exemption does not relieve you of Commerce Clause challenges.
Any questions, colleagues? Mr. Peterson, anything you want to add at this point? You are here just in case. You're invited in case we needed any explanation.
And to keep these guys apart.
Chair Dembro, Senator Bates, how am I doing?
Pretty good.
How your elbows? No, sir, I can give you a short update on where we're at, but I know this is about the Ninth Circuit decision, and we can reserve that for later if you'd like.
Great. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Wow, all three of you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll close the section on clean fuels. And our last report is a report to the 77th Legislature on study results and recommendations for House Bill 2105, which has to do with energy facility siting. So I'll call up Todd Cornett, please.
Any clear understanding of this decision yet?
Thanks.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the
siting. Yeah, hold just a second, Todd.
No, I am going to ask intelligent questions.
Let's just wait
point.
A second. Okay, go ahead.
Right. For the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Siting Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy. So I'm here today to give you an update of the report that was submitted. I've handed out a cover letter and the executive summary that was part of the report. So as indicated, this report was a requirement of House Bill 2105 in the 2013 legislative session. It directed staff to review seven particular issues related to energy facility siting and submit them in the form of a report to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly related to environment and natural resources, which is this committee. And so that report was submitted on October 30th. And the full report is available on the Oregon Department of Energy's website, also on the legislature's website. And so both the cover letter and the executive summary have links to both of those locations. So before I get into the specifics of the findings in the report, I know some of you heard this before, but it's always a good opportunity to give you a quick overview of the energy facility siting process. So our process is a standards-based process. So what that means is anybody, any applicant who can show that they meet all of the applicable standards for any particular application are obligated to get an approval. It's a consolidated review, and that means that all of the local jurisdictional, so all counties, cities where the facility is located, all state agencies, all of their permits and review processes get folded into the Energy Facility Siting Council decision. So the benefits of that is that it eliminates duplication. It eliminates potential different decisions, different appeal paths, and in the long run is intended to be a lot quicker and a lot cheaper than going through all the individual reviews. The Siting Council, the Energy Facility Siting Council, is a seven-member board. They're appointed by the governor, and they are the ultimate decision makers for all energy facilities. And the Siting Division within the Department of Energy is the primary staff to the council. The what is issued at the end of a decision is a site certificate, somewhat like a permit, but it is a little bit different in that it is a business contract between the state of Oregon and the site certificate holder. So it has some different implications, but the process, you know, is more or less a kind of a permitting process with a final decision at the end. So we think that this is the right process for the state of Oregon. I think it functions relatively well. However, there are a lot of efficiencies, and it can be certainly a lot more effective, and that's to a large degree what this report is about. So the information that we included in this report analyzed the seven issues and responded to them, and the one thing that I wanted to indicate to the committee is this is not certainly the end of our efforts to make the process work better for applicants, for the public, for everybody else who participates in it. It is just the beginning of that. And so really our intent is to continue working hard to make the process more predictable, efficient, timely, inclusive, and transparent. So in preparing the report, it went through several iterations internal to the Department of Energy, so a lot of people worked on it, and so I certainly appreciate all the effort that other people put into it as well. We also did an external review, so the draft version of it was submitted to 31 individuals representing public utilities, independent power producers, cooperatives and municipal utilities, counties, cities, state agencies, and interested citizens as well. So we really intended to solicit input and get those who participate in the process and get their thoughts on it as well. So getting into some of the key findings, there were seven issues that were indicated in the bill, and so to paraphrase them to some extent, going through A through G, these included encouraging consistency with other governments, that's local and federal, enhancing local government participation, encouraging public participation, evaluating and potentially changing some energy facility definitions, ensuring government participation, ensuring cost recovery, and then catch all anything else that we were able to think of and evaluate under other matters. So the report is approximately 30 pages long. I know you've heard some pretty detailed information today, and so you probably want to keep this as brief as possible, so my intent is to do that. So I'm not intending to go over all seven of the matters. My intent is to go through just three of them and kind of pull out some highlights, and certainly when I get to the end or in between, if you have any questions on these or any of the other elements that were addressed from the bill, I'd be happy to ask or to respond to those. So the first that I want to talk about is subsection C, which is means to encourage public participation in the design and siting of facilities. So like the state's land use process, it's intended to be, you know, include some robust public participation, not goal one gets included into our process. So we have five very distinct phases within the energy facility siting process where there is public participation. So at all those times, we reach out to the public through notification and provide opportunities for their participation. But we recognize, you know, between the time that an applicant originally comes in and the final site certificate is issued, it could be several years. And so it ends up being very lengthy. The volume of information that gets submitted creates huge complexities. The Boardman-Hemingway transmission line, the preliminary application came in at 7 feet high. So that is pretty significant. Now it's a, you know, 280-mile long or 250-mile long, I think, in the state of Oregon. Transmission line, that's pretty significant. Most come in at about a foot high. Still large volumes of information. So in order to make our best effort to incorporate the public and reach out to them and educate them, we've already identified several things, and we're working on these. One is ensuring that when we're doing public meetings, we're targeting those at the right time during the process. So we have a couple different places within the process where those are identified. We typically had or historically had done it at the front end. Turned out that was very difficult for the public, and so we've targeted that to later in the process, right before the public hearing phase. We heard a lot of concerns about the public not being able to actually testify in front of the siting council, who are the decision makers. That's because the hearing was typically conducted by a hearings officer, and so we're trying to change that by having the hearing actually in front of the council to give the public that opportunity to testify in front of them. Our website, we've done a lot of work on our website, making sure that all of our project pages are very clear, consistent, and have all the appropriate information and has the entire process laid out, so it's easy for the public to understand not only what has occurred and the information that's available, but what's going to happen and when it's going to happen. We've increased our ability for the public to participate in our council meetings. Council meetings happen about every other month. They happen throughout the state. We try to be in proximity to whatever's on the agenda. That creates a difficulty for your average citizen who's interested in tracking council meetings to participate if it's a several hundred mile drive. And so we now have a webinar. We have video cams. So it's very easy for somebody who has internet access to be able to engage much more significantly within our process, and there's an opportunity for them to provide comment on the phone as well. We also include a notification service through email, and these are managed by the individual, so that it's the ability to include any project, any number of projects that they want to receive information on, so they can self-manage what they get. The biggest thing that we've heard from both the public and from counties that we need to evaluate, and this would probably be under rulemaking, would be the notification requirements. So there's a lot of interest in us evaluating who gets noticed, how far from the project notification goes out. There's the sense from at least a lot of people right now that it's not adequate. So that's something that we want to evaluate. Under subsection D, this relates to the definition of energy facilities. So briefly, under ORS 469-311. This is the definition of energy facility, but more importantly, this is really the jurisdictional threshold for what comes to the state. So it goes through and talks about all the different types of energy facilities and lays out whatever the threshold is for them to come to the state, and anything less than that would be at the local jurisdictional level. So what we're interested in doing is evaluating the majority of these energy thresholds to determine, you know, when were they put in place, are they appropriate, should they be changed, should they be increased, should they be decreased. During the last legislative session under House Bill 2820, this was done for the solar siting. There were some significant issues with that. There were some internal contradictions to the two solar jurisdictional thresholds that had been known for some time. There was a legislative work group effort that spent the better part of 3 years working on that. Beth was instrumental in helping to move that along as well. And I think finally through the last legislative session, there ended up being enough compromise on that that the bill was passed. So that's something we want to look at, is those various definitions, and go through a similar type process of making sure that we have all the correct stakeholders at the table, and before we bring it up as a legislative concept, to make sure that there's enough consensus that something would be able to be passed. So a very long-term effort on those. And subsection E means to ensure constructive and effective participation by local governments, state agencies, and federally recognized Indian tribes in the siting of facilities. So our process is predicated on the fact that it's a consolidated review, and all of these other agencies, their standards, their permits, their processes get folded into the state energy process. And so it's incredibly important that they understand what their role is, how to participate, and participate in the best and most efficient way. And a lot of that has, we have the responsibility, like the public, to do our the best job that we can to reach out to them, to educate them, to make sure that they are aware of how to participate, and we have an understanding of how they function, so that works the best that it can. So similar to the public side, we have already identified several things, and we've already started working on those. State agency and local agency training, so we're going to be doing that on a yearly basis. We've already done two of those trainings. One occurred in Salem, which was primarily state agencies, and then one occurred in just outside of Pendleton. That was a lot of ODFW staff as well as several local governments. So we certainly intend to continue to do that on a yearly basis. We got a lot of positive feedback. Also, you know, any state agency or any local government who's interested, we're happy to come out and do a presentation to them to help explain the process to either, you know, their elected officials or their board. In December, I'm going to go to the Department of Ag board and do a presentation to them. So, you know, it's very important for us to continue doing that outreach to make sure that they understand their role and their participation in our process. One of the things that we also identified, a really important aspect, was interdisciplinary team meetings. So this happens typically in a federal project, so we decided it was a good opportunity to also do this within the state process. So early on, prior to establishing what the standards are for a particular application, when we pull in all the state and local, we get together all state and local officials and evaluate the project and sort of problem solve, bring up ideas, and that way they are more aware of what the issues are and can provide better information to us. And one of the big, most important things is not finding out about an issue late in the process. As issues raised farther on in the process, you know, the applicant has devoted significant time and resources. Agencies have done that as well. It's a lot harder to change things the farther you get down the line. And so what we're trying to do is do some early identification of issues. Part of that's through this interdisciplinary team meeting, but also it is encouraging the applicant to work with particular agencies. If we know it's in a, you know, a particularly sensitive wildlife area, you know, we'll try to initiate a conversation between the applicant and ODFW to identify issues, so at least that they're aware of, so they can either avoid those, change the location of what they're proposing, or understand the potential mitigation issues and the time and cost associated with that. So the more we can do that, we think the better it's going to be to prepare the applicants to have a better application down the line. So those are the only issues that I was going to address with kind of the particular findings. The bill also directed us to come up with some recommendations for legislation. And so at the end of the report, there are four areas for that. And it's important to indicate at this point, these are really preliminary in nature. As I indicated before, we have a lot of stakeholders who participate in our process. So it will be really important for us before we, you know, to help vet these and flesh them out before we come to, you know, the legislature with any of these concepts. We'll need to reach out to these stakeholder groups and also vet those with the rest of the department and the governor's office as well. So first is energy facility definitions. I talked about that. Again, that's going to be probably a series of long-term stakeholder outreach groups to try to evaluate and potentially change the jurisdictional thresholds within the energy facility definition. Another one in there, which I did not discuss, is creating a definition of a single energy facility. This has implications about the applicants coming in sort of just under the threshold. So us trying to create a single energy facility definition will create some clarity. The concept is already in there. It's referenced in there in the statutes and the rule. There simply isn't a definition at this point. So I think there's lack of clarity. And the next issue is under subsection E, ensuring government participation. So as I talked about, it's really important for us to ensure that the local and local governments and state agencies are participating. One of the things the statute doesn't call for, our process is cost recovery. Our costs are recovered. State agencies who participate, local governments, it's all under cost recovery. Those costs get fall to the applicant. However, any work done prior to the notice of intent coming in or any work after during compliance, the statute is silent on. And we think there are some good opportunities, again, to do some work with an applicant's blessing early on in the process, you know, to help reimburse some of the state agencies who will be participating in that process. So that's something we'd like to look into. Similarly, any compliance issues after the fact, sometimes we might need the assistance of state agencies for their expertise to implement certain conditions. Again, that we would like to look into the idea of reimbursement of those agencies for that purpose.
And Todd, and that might become legislation requirement.
Yeah, Chair Dembro, the cost recovery piece is solely in statute, and so for us to clarify that, it would be legislation.
And that's not something you're going to have consensus on in the next week.
No, Chair Dembro, I do not see that coming into the 2014 session. We'd be lucky if it was in the 2015 session. But again, we'll have to reach out to stakeholders and, you know, make sure that, you know, it's set and ready to go. Also, tribal government reimbursement. It's very explicit about state agency and local government reimbursement. It's not about tribal government reimbursement. So we are obligated to send specifically identified tribes all the project information as well, so they can evaluate potential impacts to archaeological resources. So again, because there's no definitive language about their reimbursement, that's something that we'd like to explore. Subsection F, ensuring cost recovery. So that's really the whole purpose of the statute, ORS 469, 421, is to ensure that the costs associated with these projects are reimbursed by the applicant, that it's full cost recovery. As we've realized in the last couple of years, there's some issues within there that could be clarified to have better sort of controls and protocols to ensure that cost recovery happens in a timely and efficient manner. So, again, something that we need to explore. Will certainly involve, you know, all utilities and independent power producers to make sure that they understand what we're doing and kind of the reason behind it before we would come with any legislation. And then the final potential legislative issue on here is under the other matters. We had several a couple of appeals recently, and those highlighted some clarity that's needed for some statutes, and this is related to the local governmental standards that apply in an amendment. So when an applicant comes in, just like at the beginning of the process, you know, we pull into the application all local government standards. So there's some potential contradictory language in statute, which we think needs to be clarified to ensure that we and the applicants and local government knows when an amendment occurs, you know, what are the local government standards that are applicable to that amendment. So we think that's an important thing to look through. And, again, we will, you know, work with all of the appropriate stakeholders to make sure that that's clarified, the intent is there, and that the language is appropriate before we bring it to the legislature. So, again, it was a 30-page document. A lot of effort went into it. And, you know, I could go in probably for a long time. I certainly don't want to do that. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them. But that, at this point, concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Todd. I do have a question. I haven't had a chance to look at the report yet, but does it include timelines for when these various recommendations that you've spoken about and the others are going to be implemented, you know, what the timeline for following up on these recommendations are?
Chair Dembro, no, it doesn't. We had a fairly limited timeline in between when the legislation was passed and the time that it was needed to get done. And we actually had that same question from several of our stakeholders who we sent the draft out to. They were much interested in knowing kind of what the timelines were on some of these things. One of the things that we really want to use this for is, again, not a, all right, we've done this, it's on the shelf, we, you know, we move on to the next thing. You know, we want this to be a living document. We want this to be, in effect, an annual work program. It may not look the same, it may not be, you know, responding to the same issues that were raised, but the in terms of what the House Bill 2105 said, but in terms of what we're trying to achieve, you know, as we do this on an annual basis, I think that's how we're going to develop this, is, you know, identify these issues, what we need to do, what we want to do, and add timelines to those so people can see that and they can know, you know, when that's coming down the line and whether or not they want to participate in the various kind of outreach that we're going to need to do. Mm-hmm. So the short answer is no, but we're going to do that.
Yeah. And how quickly do you think you could do that? Because I think it would be useful, obviously, for your planning purposes, but also just to help monitor progress on the recommendations.
Chair Dembro, I believe in the next 6 months we'll be looking to change this into more of an annual work program, and that's when we'd be including some of those elements. At this point, we're the volume of projects that we have has gone down significantly in the last year. Over the last 3 or 4 years, we had a huge volume, an unprecedented volume of applications. We are seeing sort of the last kind of end of those. We still have about 10 significant projects going on, but we have 3 right now that are going through at the same level, and that's taking a lot of time and resources, and which is why it was a bit of a struggle to get this out in a timely manner. So we think once we're sort of through those, it will free up several of staff members' time, mine included, to be able to focus on this and other things.
So would it be reasonable to expect by our May legislative days that you could have the first iteration available?
Chair Dembro, I think that would be workable.
Great. Okay. And then finally, just to clarify, so we don't have to worry about anything for 2014, is that right, on this issue?
Chair Dembro, not from us. we don't have anything at this point that we're ready to propose for legislation. That doesn't mean somebody else is not going to propose legislation related to the energy facility siting process.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Okay, thank you very much for this report. All right, with that, I will close that. section, and our very final section is potential committee bills. At this point, we don't have committee bills. However, I have just this afternoon heard some interest from the governor's office on a couple of issues. One related to what's going on down with the Klamath that Richard Whitman is working on, and there's some potential consensus around something having to do with temporary water rights. And so we're going to follow up on that, and I'll let you know. And and the second has to do potentially with environmental impact assessments in some way, and I need some more clarity about that. But yes, Senator Bates?
On the Klamath situation, you know, this is a discussion with the tribes, or is it downriver from the tribes? You know the difference. There's two broad situations. One is waters coming into the lake are under tribal control, and that's been pretty well settled. And they cut all the ranchers off this summer because of the drought. But downstream, there's a couple other issues that we might have more jurisdiction. Has the governor's office been talking to the tribes, come up with a plan or a discussion?
My understanding is that this is the product of kind of broad conversations and potential consensus. That's how it was that's how it was reported to me.
But you don't know if the tribes are involved or not?
I don't know specifically, but that would be my assumption. I was told this would be an easy one. I would like to think that the tribes are involved.
Okay, you're only as close as I do. Okay.
Anyway, I'll let you know when I know.
Yeah, I mean, it even affects things over in the Rogue Valley, so it's really important.
Of course.
We suck some of their water out, so. Okay.
And Senator Olson, any?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, great. Okay, well, with that, then, we will adjourn this committee meeting, and we'll be back in January. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Great.